This is True Crime Psychology and Personality, where we discuss the pathology behind some of the most horrific crimes and those who committed them from a scientifically informed perspective.
I'm Dr. Todd Grande. I have a PhD in counselor education and supervision, and I'm a licensed professional counselor of mental health. Dr. Todd Grande, that's my YouTube channel.
Today's question is, can I analyze the case of Jonathan Foster? First, I'll look at the background of this case, move to the timeline of the crime, then offer my analysis. Jonathan Foster was born in November 1998. His parents, Richard Foster and Angela Davis, separated when he was young. His uncle, Glenn Scrimshire, took care of him for several years. Jonathan lived with Glenn, Glenn's wife, and their five children on a farm in Missouri. Glenn told the media that Angela was not fit to take care of Jonathan because of drugs and alcohol. Presumably, he meant that Angela had used substances. In November 2009, Jonathan was sent to live with his grandmother in Texas. Not long after this, he moved in with his mother, Angela, and his stepfather, David Davis. In late 2010, Angela and David separated because Angela believed that David had slapped Jonathan across the face. Angela and Jonathan moved into an apartment that was rented by one of Angela's friends named Sharon Enamorado. Now moving to the timeline of the crime. On December 24, 2010, Christmas Eve, Angela had to work and decided to leave Jonathan alone in the apartment. Again, this was Sharon's apartment. Texas does not have a law stating a minimum age for a child to be left home unsupervised, although the caregiver assumes liability for anything that happens to the child if the child is under 15 years old. Perhaps as a way of minimizing her liability, Angela told Jonathan not to let anyone in the apartment when she was gone. Angela then went to her job as a cashier at a nearby store. At around 2 p.m., someone called Angela's employer looking for Angela. Her supervisor told the caller that Angela was busy and then told Angela that someone had called looking for her. It's not clear who the caller was. Some reports indicate that it was Jonathan. Others indicate it was an unknown woman. Whoever the caller was, based on what they told the supervisor, Angela attempted to call Jonathan. She was unable to get a hold of him. She left work and started driving toward the apartment as she continued to call. Eventually, a strange woman answered the phone. Angela said something like, "My name is Angela, I am Jonathan's mother." Angela could hear the woman say to Jonathan, "Is your mama's name Angela?" Angela then heard Jonathan respond, "Yes, ma'am, my mama's name is Angela." After that, the call disconnected. Angela arrived at the apartment not long after this. She realized that Jonathan was not there. In addition, the portable phone was missing. The base for the phone was there, but the handset was gone. A computer screen had a game on it, and cartoons were playing on the television. Angela called Jonathan's stepfather, David, but he did not seem to be too concerned. He told her he would come by when he had a chance. At around 3:45 p.m., Angela reported Jonathan missing to the police. When officers arrived at the scene, they noticed that there was no sign of a struggle in the apartment. Angela and David allegedly told the police that Jonathan was with a babysitter in the apartment, only to change their story later and admit that he had been left alone. The police said this deception caused a delay in the investigation. Due to this odd behavior and the report about David allegedly slapping Jonathan, the police believed that David could have been involved. When they interviewed David, he tried to minimize the slapping behavior, but he did admit to striking Jonathan. As far as his alibi, David said that he had seen Jonathan at 1:30 p.m. He had stopped by the apartment to check on him. After this, David told the police this bizarre story about going out to buy a coffee grinder. Instead of buying the coffee grinder, he ended up at a bar drinking beer. The police were able to verify his alibi. David was at a bar until almost 3:30 p.m. He was cleared as a potential suspect, but definitely out of the running for Stepfather of the Year award. The police also checked out Richard Foster, Jonathan's biological father. He had an alibi, which the police were able to confirm. The police were out of potential suspects. They had no idea what happened to Jonathan. The investigation would take a dramatic turn on December 28, 4 days after Jonathan went missing, a person walking through an industrial park on East Hardy Road in Houston discovered human remains partially inside a concrete culvert in a ditch. This was about 5 miles from the place where Jonathan lived. The police were eventually able to identify the body as Jonathan Foster. His hands were tied behind his back with twine. His body had been burned with a torch, and he was wrapped in carpet. The damage to his body was so extensive that the cause of death could not be determined. The police located a surveillance camera that was not far away on the side of a building overlooking the road and the ditch. The video captured a silver pickup truck coming to a stop along the road on December 24 at 6:06 p.m. This was just a few hours after Jonathan went missing. A person can be seen exiting the pickup truck, pulling some large object out of the bed, and moving it to the concrete culvert. A car drove by when the truck was parked there. The person appeared to hide from the passing vehicle. It did not take long for the police to figure out who owned the silver pickup truck. It was a 44-year-old woman named Mona Yvette Nelson. She was described as an acquaintance of Angela's family. Sharon, the woman who rented the apartment where Angela and Jonathan lived, was familiar with Mona and explained to the police what Mona may have been doing at the apartment, like how Mona came to be in contact with Jonathan. Sharon said that she had invited Mona to a party at her home on Christmas Eve. For some reason, Mona was going to arrive at the apartment before Sharon was present. Therefore, Sharon anticipated that getting into the residence could be a problem for Mona. She knew that Jonathan would probably not let Mona into the apartment. In order to get around this problem, Sharon told Mona to tell Jonathan that Aunt Sharon said it was okay. If Jonathan had any problems, he was to call Sharon. Mona later told Sharon that after arriving at the residence, Jonathan would not open the door. Mona said that she would come back later. The police interviewed Mona. Here's the story that she gave to them. Mona admitted that she had been at the apartment a few hours before Jonathan disappeared. She spoke to him, but then left. Nothing happened. It was a homicide-free encounter. As Mona was talking to the police, she indicated that she had acetylene tanks in the dining area of a residence. The police searched her residence and found the tanks and quite a bit of additional inculpatory evidence. Mona changed her story and admitted that she did dump Jonathan's body in the ditch. She falsely claimed that David Davis, Jonathan's stepfather, had asked her to dispose of the contents of a trash can. She did not know anything about what was in the trash can, and she didn't know about the homicide. By this point, the police already knew that David Davis was not involved.
Hello, this is Gary Chahot welcoming you to check out the French History Podcast. Our main show covers the history of France from the first humans until present. If you liked Mike Duncan's The History of Rome and wanted a similar program covering the land of beauty, culture, and love, we are exactly that. We also host world-renowned scholars who have delivered guest episodes on their specialties, including 18th century pirates, revolutionary booksellers in 20th century Paris, the special friendship between the Marquis de Lafayette and Thomas Jefferson, and numerous others. Learn what you love and listen to the French History Podcast today.
True terrors of horror, bizarre happenings, unexplainable events. On our podcast, Disturbed, terror takes center stage. Each episode is a journey into the darkest corners of human existence, delving into bone-chilling tales of kidnappings, serial killers, maniacs, and the very essence of your worst nightmares coming to life on this weekly true horror show. Disturbed is not for the faint of heart. It's an exploration of real, unadulterated horror sourced from everyday people. Each episode is a descent into the macabre, where we narrate stories that will leave you on the edge of your seat and crawling in your skin. We navigate the disturbing narratives that lurk in the shadows, offering a raw and unfiltered listen into the most terrifying aspects of the human experience. Enter at your own risk and let the unsettling tales unfold in the haunting realm of Disturbed. And remember, listeners, stay safe out there.
On December 30, 2010, Mona was charged with capital murder. The police believed that she acted alone. The theory of the crime was that Mona had been drinking a lot of alcohol on Christmas Eve. She became angry at Jonathan because he initially refused to let her into the apartment. She punched Jonathan in the chest, took him to her residence, and tied him up. Mona used a cutting torch to burn Jonathan. It's not clear if this was the cause of death or not. Again, the authorities could not figure out the cause of death due to the condition of Jonathan's body. Mona put the body in a trash can, drove to the industrial park, and tried to hide the body in the concrete culvert. Mona went to trial for murder in August of 2013. She was convicted of capital murder and sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Now moving to my analysis. Mona maintains her innocence. She is actively trying to get released from prison and has a few supporters. Was Mona actually guilty of murder? Let's take a look at the evidence both for and against the idea that Mona was guilty, starting with the inculpatory factors. Mona lied about her alibi. She said that she was drinking with a man from 2 to 6 p.m. The police spoke to the man, and he said that Mona left at 2 p.m. Mona eventually admitted to the police that she dumped Jonathan's body in the ditch. She claimed that she was not involved in the homicide and tried to implicate Jonathan's stepfather, who could not have been involved because he was drinking at a bar. The police searched Mona's residence. They found cutting torches, oxygen tanks, acetylene tanks, and other tools that are used in welding. The damage to Jonathan's body was consistent with an oxygen acetylene cutting torch. In Mona's trash can, they found Jonathan's Looney Tunes sweatshirt and pieces of carpet similar to the carpet that was found around his body. Leaves were discovered by the trash can, which matched leaves found in the ditch where the body was dropped. There were no trees with those types of leaves anywhere near the ditch. The police also discovered twine that matched the twine that was around Jonathan's hands. A witness had seen Mona and Mona's silver Ford F-150 pickup truck outside of Jonathan's apartment on Christmas Eve. The pickup truck looked a lot like the one captured in the surveillance video of the scene where the body was dropped. Mona had been drinking heavily right before she interacted with Jonathan. People said that she became very angry and violent when she was intoxicated. Mona had a long history of criminal activity, including violent crime. Moving to the exculpatory factors, there is no clear motive in this case other than Mona being upset with Jonathan because he would not let her into the apartment. That's about it for exculpatory factors. When considering all the evidence, do I think that Mona Nelson is guilty? Yes, I do not think there is any doubt in this case. Moving to the next section, here are my thoughts on a few items that stood out to me in this case. Item number one is Mona's background. Mona was born in 1966. She never completed high school. In 1984, Mona pleaded guilty to aggravated robbery and was sentenced to 10 years of probation. She went to prison in 1991 after her probation was revoked. Mona was released in 1994. In addition to the aggravated robbery charge, Mona had other involvement with the criminal justice system. She had faced drug charges and on one occasion had been accused of threatening a woman. As far as her non-criminal career, Mona was a professional boxer in 2004. She had one victory and three losses before being suspended for 30 days by the Association of Boxing Commissions. It's not clear why she was suspended, but I'm guessing it wasn't over allegations of cheating, considering her record. At the time of the murder, Mona was a maintenance worker and a welder. Item number two, in order to explain why she disposed of the victim's body, Mona made up a story about being given $20 to dump the contents of a trash can. She claimed that she chose the ditch randomly. She was drinking as she was driving around. So part of her defense was that she was too busy committing a crime to be committing another crime. Item number three, Mona continues to maintain her innocence. she has managed to deceive other people into advocating on her behalf. Before she was convicted, Mona declared that she was not a monster. She had 5 grandchildren and loved kids. After Mona was sentenced to life in prison, she told the judge that an innocent person was going to prison. I hope they can identify the innocent person and prevent that injustice. But in the meantime, the guilty person, Mona, needs to be in prison. Moving to my final item, number 4, what was the motive for this crime? There are many theories. Mona may have killed other people before. Perhaps she was a serial killer and Jonathan was simply the next victim. She did have a violent history, but she was never connected to any other murders. Mona may have killed Jonathan due to his race. The media buried any hint of that theory immediately, almost certainly for political reasons. It's difficult to ignore the possibility that race was involved, but there's no way to prove this was the case. Another theory is that she killed Jonathan because she was intoxicated and angry at him for not letting her into the apartment. This is a weak motive. Mona was intoxicated frequently, but she didn't kill anybody before this. Also, she was functional enough to dispose of the body. She clearly had some control over what she was doing. I think the motive in this case was probably sexual domination, just like so many homicides involving an adult perpetrator and a young victim who did not know each other. Mona wanted to kill someone, and Jonathan was an easy target. Perhaps she had been fantasizing about it for a while and was just waiting for the opportunity. From prison, Mona could attempt to explain her motive to help people understand what could have happened, but that would involve accepting responsibility. The chances of Mona doing that are even less than her chances of winning a boxing match.
This has been True Crime Psychology and Personality from Ars Longa Media. This content is for educational and entertainment purposes only. Ars Longa, Vita Brevis.
Hi, this is Amy and Vanessa from She Goes By Jane, where we shine light on the stories of missing and unidentified women. On November 7th, we're sharing Nahida's story for the first time in a podcast. And this is a story that I thought I knew, but after reading police reports, became more complicated than I thought. When investigators are called to Nahida Khatib's house, everything looks fine. Her purse is on the kitchen table, her cup of coffee is on the counter, and her 2-year-old niece is in her playpen. The only thing amiss? Nahida is missing.
Every week, we feature a poem written in honor of the person we're talking about. This week, we're joined by one of our favorite actresses. You might know her from Sister Act or King of the Hill or The Descendants. But if you're like us, you'll know her from Hocus Pocus. She's the much-beloved Kathy Najimy. Join us November 7th to hear Nahida's story.